This is day two at the 52nd New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our second period speaker is Brother Ron Hoban on Show Us, Lord, Show Us the Father. The subtitle for today is The Word Became Flesh and Tabernacled Among Us. This is the second talk in his series, and the introductory reading is John chapter 1, verses 14 to 34. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Robert. Very good. Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. So, picking up right where we left off yesterday, we considered the prologue to John's Gospel and how it fits our theme of the tabernacle in John's Gospel, the place of God's dwelling place, where God would be manifest no longer in a tent, but in a person, in that of his own son. And that record we just read, which continues on, kind of demonstrates that principle of in the beginning was the Word, because now we come into the actual story of the event after the prologue, and you are immediately introduced into John the Baptist, aren't you? And they ask him and say, you know, who are you? Are you Elijah? And he said, no. Are you that prophet? And he said, no. And they said, well, who are you then? He says, I'm a voice. So in the beginning was the Word, and I'm a voice in the wilderness, which was what happened in the beginning with Israel, wasn't it? The Word was heard in the wilderness at Mount Sinai, the voice which spoke from the mountain and proclaimed that which eventually would come in the form of the manifestation of the dwelling place of God, which was seen in the pattern and the design that Moses was given in the mountain to build a place where God would dwell. And the very next thing you're introduced into John is then came Jesus down. And here is the dwelling place of God with man seen in his son. So we suggested that this theme of the tabernacle in John's Gospel runs all the way through and is a major theme in the Gospel. So much so that, you know, it really is the essence of the Gospel, and that's why it's called the Gospel of God Manifestation. When you compare the subject of the tabernacle and you compare the other Gospels, they do appear, but nothing like the extent that it appears in John's Gospel. And of course, this is our key verse, which we've looked at already, in terms of the subject. And the Word became flesh and lived in his tent, or pitched his tent among us. And unlike Sinai, which was all about not approaching or not touching or not breaking through and gazing upon God's glory, it says, we gazed at his glory. We fully gazed at his glory and saw him. And as John also said in his epistle, we touched him. We got up close and personal with the glory of God. There were no barriers. The subject of the temple, as it's seen in John, is set in contrast to that which was temporary in the wilderness, that which was the tabernacle, which was the temporary dwelling place that God had. The temple features more in John's Gospel than the other three Gospels put together. In fact, if you look at the other three Gospels, Luke has the recording of when Jesus was dedicated at the temple when he was a child of just 8 days old when Mary took him up to the temple in Luke chapter 2. Other than that, the only other events recorded in all three of the Gospels is the last event, in terms of Jesus' appearance in the temple. Whereas John's Gospel pretty much revolves around events happening in and around the temple. In fact, there's only a few exclusions to events that happened in the temple. The wedding at Cana, the woman of Samaria, the feeding of the 5,000, and the raising of Lazarus, which very close to the temple, but deliberately set outside the temple. Other than that, everything recorded in John's Gospel happen in and around the temple, and you'll see it features. You know, destroy this temple, Jesus said, and I will raise it in 3 days. And as we suggested, this is a direct allusion to the permanence of Herod's temple, which I might have misstated, actually took 80 years to build. By the time in Jesus' day, in around AD 30, it was 46 years in the building. It took another 34 years to complete, and it was completed in AD 63, just 7 years before it was destroyed. So it took 80 years in construction. And Jesus said, destroy this temple and I'll rear it up in 3 days, which was a great allusion to the story of the tabernacle, where God would dwell with man. The woman of Samaria said, our fathers worshipped in this mountain. I go back one because I got too fast with my button there. I've gone back two now. We have to destroy the temple again. I just wanted to show you that slide again, actually, because it's kind of cool. But I have to slow down with this button. Right. So, the woman of Samaria said, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, speaking of Mount Gerizim, but you Jews, say in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. So you see, again, the focus, even with the case of the woman of Samaria, which we're going to come back to particularly in our last study, the woman of Samaria was very concerned about the place of worship, whether it was in Gerizim or in Jerusalem. In the case of the man by the pool of Bethesda, after he was healed, it specifically makes record that Jesus found him in the temple and says, behold, thou art made whole. Go and sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you. In chapter 7, it records the events where it says, and Jesus, in the midst of the feast, went up into the midst of the temple. So the focus in chapter 7 is all around being in the temple. Again, later on, at the end, it says, he cried in the temple, and teaching, saying, that's in the last day of the great day of the Feast of Tabernacles during the water pouring ceremony. And then the very next day, early in the morning, he came back into the temple. And this was the event where they brought him the woman caught in the act of adultery. But again, all the focus is in the temple as he came into the temple and taught them. In John chapter 10, during the Feast of Dedication, it was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in Solomon's porch. And so you see the focus over and over again. Herod's temple was a magnificent structure. In context of the size of it, it's like 4 rugby fields in size put together. So you can imagine it was just set there as an amazing structure that they would, you know, elevate it upon the top of Mount Zion. So no wonder it was, when Jesus was, you know, only a boy, that he got lost, or his parents lost them in the temple, because there would have been so many people there during the time of Passover going up. And an incredible structure. It was surrounded by 10 gates all the way around the temple, where many people could enter, providing you were Jewish. Only ever the Jews were able to enter into that structure. So if you were Jewish, you were allowed to enter in. Otherwise, you were not. And it was all set out in order, you know, according to the principle which was set up, first of all, in the tabernacle, but was also seen in the building of Solomon's temple, and later on in the temple that they built after they returned from captivity. So that gives you some, that's a bit of an impression, gives you a bit of a 3D impression of just how magnificent Herod's temple was. It was a place where people saw that's where you went to worship God. That's where God was. You see, God eventually was going to reject this temple. He was going to reject this people because they rejected the true temple of God. Now, David mentioned a great word yesterday, theophany. Theophany, by description, means God, theophany, God manifest, God revealed. with man. Before the building of the tabernacle, what incidents can you think of where you see an example of God with man, God dwelling with man? What events are there that you can think of before the tabernacle? Garden of Eden, excellent. That's the first one. God walked and talked with man. Enoch walked and talked with God. Yes, that's a good one. Haven't got that one. Abraham, that's a really good one. Specifically, there's one really good one with Abraham. I was thinking of the sacrifice of Isaac, particularly. There is probably the one with Sodom, where God came down and the destruction of Sodom, but particularly in the sacrifice of Isaac. Any other ones you can think of before the tabernacle? Noah's Ark, that's a great one, isn't it? Because God shut the door, so God was in there, of course, called him into the ark. There was a whole symbol of the tabernacle, wasn't it? They pitched within and out with pitch. So Noah's Ark is a very good one. Moses at the bush, excellent one, isn't it? God came down right there at the bush. Moses, take your shoes off. The place whereof you stand is holy. So it's interesting that when you look at the first chapter of John that we have just read and think about all of those and all of those times where God first appeared, have you ever thought that they're all there in John chapter 1? Let's have a look at them in John chapter 1. And you'll see all of those times that God dwells. Well, we know, of course, in the beginning. And it's really interesting that even in the Garden of Eden, the whole structure of the tabernacle was there in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve, isn't it? Because you look at the structure of the Garden of Eden and you had these different areas that were set apart. Of course, there was the centerpiece within the garden, and it was within the Garden of Eden itself. In fact, maybe we should start from the outside, because remember, outside the land of Eden was Naughty Land. That's the place where Cain was sent into Naughty Land, wasn't he? The land of Nod. It was outside. He was sent always in the direction further east. He went out further away. So he went away out into the land of Nod. But then you had a place which was called Eden, and that was separated from the outside, which was called the Naughty Land. And obviously there was, you know, there was a border that bordered, because God set apart and he marked out a place that he called Eden. And it's separated from that which was the land of Nod. And then within the garden, it says eastward in Eden, sorry, he planted a garden. So east of the land of Eden, he planted a garden. And then even within the garden, there is a separate place. Because you'll notice that there's a place, it says in Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, where God planted in the midst of the garden. It was kind of in the garden, but it was separated in itself, called the midst of the garden. And there were specifically two trees in that area, the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. Now, it's really interesting, I find, because this does have the pattern of the tabernacle. And probably the greatest evidence of the fact is that what did God set here? Oh, it's already on the picture. It's probably too small, so you might not see it. At the garden, what did he set after the transgression? Yep, and they were to protect that which was in the midst. Now, have you ever thought to yourself, why were the cherubim only needed to be in the east? Now, you've got a garden. How do you protect the west? How do you protect the north? How do you protect the south? I mean, it's just a garden. What did he have around the rest of it? Why is the protection only at the east of the garden? Because there's only one way into the garden. Only one way into that garden, isn't there? Through the east. Now into the tabernacle, There was only one way into the tabernacle. Now, all of you great scholars here, you know, there on the east was the entrance into the tabernacle. That was the only door. So all you great scholars, tell me, on the west, what were the tribes which faced the west? Ephraim? Ephraim, Joseph, what's that? Ephraim, Joseph, and Benjamin. So Nan's the great scholar. That's really Manasseh, yeah. So now imagine, you know, you've got, you know, a little child there, from one of these little Manasseh boys, and he says, "Dad, why do we have to walk around all the time? It's a long way around to get around this tabernacle, and we've got to go past all these other tribes. Why do we always have to go last to get to that gate?" He said, "Actually, I could probably just sneak under the curtain. Look, Dad, there's a gap in the curtain. We could go in this way." But God said, "No, there's only one way in to the tabernacle." Because there is only one way, isn't there? Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And you can't go any other way into the tabernacle. And that's why there's only one gate into the Garden of Eden, because there is only one way into the garden. And that principle is laid out there in John. So the other story that comes very shortly after the story of the Garden of Eden, of course, is the story of Noah's Ark. And you see that principle, of course, of God dwelling in the Ark. And God sent out of the Ark two different types of birds, didn't he? One was the raven, which of course was a symbol of death. Why was the raven a symbol of death? Because it fed on carrion. It can feed on dead bodies. And so Noah sent out the two birds, and the raven didn't come back. Why? Well, it's pretty obvious, wasn't it? There was probably a lot of floating dead bodies, and the raven was like, "This is pretty cool." So it could just pick up all the dead bodies that were there, and it had a feast, a smorgasbord on anything that was there. Whereas the dove flew out, and doves are very different, aren't they? Doves are very, very particular. Total contrast between that which is black and that which is white. And the dove, of course, doves don't like putting their feet on things which are unclean. Doves are very particular. And the dove, of course, came back again until the dove, you know, could find life. And the dove was the one that came back and could spot that which was full of life. Now, in the story of John, of course, you're immediately introduced to the story of Jesus and his baptism. And John says of Jesus, when he comes down to Jordan, what does he say? Sorry? Yes, behold, the Lamb of God. So what do we know about lambs? What do we know about Jesus in terms of being a lamb? He was the perfect lamb, wasn't he? So here you've got this record of the Spirit descending from heaven upon Jesus, and you've got the story of the lamb as well. Because the Spirit comes down like a dove and lands on a lamb. Now, in the story of the offering of Abraham, Abraham offering up Isaac, of course, God said to Abraham, or Abraham said to Isaac, God himself will provide a lamb for a burnt offering. And that wasn't fulfilled until the time when John said, "Behold the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world." The burnt offering, which would take away the sin. Burnt morning and evening. And so here you have this incredible picture. He named the place, of course, Jehovah Jireh, that is to say, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. But you've got this picture of this beautiful lamb, perfect, and then a dove comes down to rest on the lamb. By selection process, this bird, which represents that which is life in Noah's Ark, selects the lamb and comes and lands on it. Well, that's the other story. What about the other one with Moses? Moses came near to the mount, up to the bush, and God say to Moses, "Moses, take your shoes off. Be because where you're standing is too holy for you to wear your sandals for what you touch. What did John say to Jesus when Jesus came down? He said, he who comes after me, his sandals, I'm not worthy to unloose. You don't find many examples of people taking their shoes off in the Bible, but John makes specific reference of the fact that when Jesus came down, John said, I can't even touch his sandals. So holy is this man, I wouldn't even presume to get down and undo his sandals because he is holy ground. Now, there's one other one that we missed in terms of talking about the theophany, and that is the story here, isn't it? Remember this story? Jacob in his dream. Here was a picture of where God came down to man, isn't it? In Bethel, which means, of course, house of God, the place of God. And here in Genesis chapter 28, you've got reference specifically to the house of God. You've got reference to the gate of heaven being opened. And you've got reference to a stone there, which was going to be used by Jacob to set up as a pillar, and that stone was going to be to help him remember that God would keep him in the way, and that stone itself becomes the house of God. John chapter 1, of course, finishes with these words. Hereafter you shall see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Every example in the Old Testament, prior to the building of the tabernacle, was alluded to in John chapter 1. The places where God came and dwelt with man. So you can see the theme is just, it's just breathing through John that this is what Jesus is representing, God's dwelling place. The stone, by the way, appears neatly with the story of Cephas as well, because John chapter 1, Jesus turns to Peter and says, thou art Cephas. Your name shall be called Peter. So there you've got, you shall be called Cephas, the stone. So the pebble becomes the stone. Later on, Jesus would say to him, this stone, this rock, is what I will build my ecclesia on. And of course, Peter is going to be the one, the stone, like in Jacob's day, is taken to build the ecclesia, set up as a pillar in the house of God. And there's the quote, he who overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God in my Father's house and many mansions. Now, I just wanted to show you that just as a quick sort of, again, reinforcing this theme, because this theme is going to get stronger and stronger, and then the lesson of it is going to come out. And here's part of the lesson. When you looked at Herod's temple, as we said, there was all sorts of different areas. There was actually even an area for the chamber of the lepers set up in Herod's temple. So this was in the process of the purification of the lepers, when the priests would come and inspect them, and they had to go through that process of purification. They had a chamber of the lepers. There was the courtyard of the woman. There was the courtyard of the Nazarites. There was the chamber of oil, the chamber of wood. And then outside, you see? Nowhere inside. Outside, of course, is the Gentiles. Because the Gentiles weren't to come inside anywhere into the part of the temple. Which is why in John's Gospel you get to this climax in John chapter 12 when two Greeks come to Philip and say, we would see Jesus. Philip goes to Andrew and Andrew says, well, let's go and see Jesus. And he goes and tells Jesus that there's some Greeks wanting to see him. And Jesus turned around and says, now is the Son glorified. Because now the Gentiles are going to be called in. So the thing with Herod's temple, there were different degrees of separation, wasn't there? And it was the same with the tabernacle. Different degrees of separation. So there you had, right in the middle, God's, the most holy place where God was. And then you got separated depending on who you are. Do you know, you had to have the right pedigree. You had to be born into the right family. You had to wear the right clothes in order to get closer and closer to God. And if you were like a nobody, you were just in the camp, separated by all sorts of degrees of separation because you weren't of the Levitical family. Well, then it got worse. What if you were unclean? And it suggested that probably a quarter of the camp was unclean at any one time. You know, a quarter of the camp's outside the camp. It's crazy. There was all these different degrees of separation. And what happened was, the Jews believed in their mind that these degrees of separation was all about who was to be excluded. But what God was actually teaching was what he wanted to include. The door to the tabernacle was not about who was going to be kept out. It's about who could come in. And in the end, they would all be found to be unclean. Anyway, in the story of John's Gospel, there's something unique about this which becomes very powerful. And herein is our real exhortation, the beginning of our exhortation. The people Jesus deals with in John's Gospel are those that are the furthest outside. You know, here's this woman. John chapter 4. Think about this woman. Think about her in perhaps ecclesial life today. Imagine this woman. You know, as far as the Jews were concerned, as far as the disciples were concerned, they were horrified. They were horrified that Jesus was speaking to this woman. They couldn't believe it. The woman couldn't believe it. How is it you being a Jew is talking to me? She could not believe it herself. The disciples couldn't believe it. But you know, they didn't know what Jesus knew, did they? Because there's other things about this woman. It wasn't just that she was a Samaritan. There was a reason she was going to that well in the middle of the day. She was a woman that had a pretty bad reputation. She, you know, had had five husbands. And the man she was with was not her husband, Jesus said. She was in a de facto relationship. Now, I want you to think about that in terms of our ecclesial life, because this kind of is uncomfortable. She had a lot of baggage. We struggle to deal with people with a lot of baggage, and this woman had a lot of baggage, didn't she? And the disciples had trouble dealing with her just because she was a Samaritan. Had they known the full story, which Jesus knew, how would they have dealt with her? How would we have dealt with her? You know, she's a difficult case. A very difficult case. She's as far outside the camp as you can imagine. And she has a lot of issues. But Jesus goes out of his way to find this woman. What about this man? John chapter 5. It appears that Jesus goes to the pool of Bethesda and he's looking for the worst case scenario, isn't he? He scans the pool of Bethesda and sees all of those people and he says, that's the man. And he goes straight up to this man who's been 38 years in this situation. 38 years an invalid. He picks the worst example. And how would this man sit in terms of the law? Well, because, you know, he was a cripple, he would never find his way into the temple. It was hopeless for him. Life was hopeless for him. In fact, you could see life was hopeless for him. We'll come back and look a little bit closer to him in our next study. What about this guy? John chapter 9. He said to Jesus, the disciples looked at this man and said, which man sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And the man himself, this blind man, said to the Pharisees, he said, well, herein is a marvelous thing. Has it ever been seen that a man who was born blind was healed? Has it ever been seen? Search the scriptures. Lots of blind people were healed. No one that was born blind ever. And in fact, the whole process that Jesus goes to heal this man is like he gave him a new set of eyes. You know, spat, put it on clay. Clay mingled with his word, put it on his eyes, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, and all of a sudden it's like he's got new eyes. It's a creative act. Something that's, he didn't heal something that was broken. It was like he made something new. And God gave the son this incredible ability to give this man a new pair of eyes. And the man came seeing. But how far outside of the law was he? In David's day, the blind and the maimed should not enter into the tabernacle, into the temple. And so it was that at the end of this man in John chapter 9 got to go into the temple for the first time in his life. How exciting was that? He got disfellowshipped on day one. First day he's allowed in the temple, he gets disfellowshipped. And Jesus goes and finds him. What about this woman, John chapter 8? Oh, this is a cut and dry case. There's no ambiguity. Look at the evidence. She was caught in the very act of adultery, and we've got witnesses. I could almost imagine the disciples starting to pick up stones. And I was like, this is clear cut. We don't need any argument here. Moses said in the law, she should be stoned. Boom, she should be stoned. You can't argue with this. It's black and white. It's in the law. It's written. It has to be done. And what did Jesus do? Does no man condemn thee? Neither do I condemn thee. He went out of his way to find these absolute worst-case scenarios, didn't he? And John's full of them. This woman, Mary Magdalene, detailed in John chapter 20, amazing story of this woman, Mary Magdalene, out of whom was cast, what? Seven devils. She was a complete, absolute mental fruitcake, wasn't she? She was as nutty as they come before she met Jesus. And Jesus goes out of his way to heal this woman. Totally outside. They were the most extreme examples. And what about this person? How more outside the law do you get than this person? Do you know, anybody that touched a dead person was defiled. He was separated. Jesus deals with a dead person. In fact, so much so that the story of the healing of Lazarus is very much the story of the red heifer. Because the red heifer is one of those unusual stories in the law. That was like the exception to the law. Because the red herring broke all, you know, what you might call the normality of the law. Red herring? Yes, the red heifer. The red heifer, the red herring. It's a Freudian slip. Unintended pun. Anyway. There, you have this story of the red heifer, which was really unusual in all sorts of ways, wasn't it? You imagine again, you're a kid, a child, and you're watching all of these things taking place because it was lots of exciting things that happened in the tabernacle, wasn't there? In fact, when it first started, it would have been so exciting. Imagine seeing that pillar of fire. That would have been incredible on day one. Imagine seeing it a week later. It's still been amazing. Look, Dad, look, there's a pillar of fire there. It's awesome. After week one. Imagine after 6 months. Oh, did you see that? What? The pillar. Oh, yeah. It's just there all the time. All of these signs, the familiarity of these signs, you know, would have become so familiar to them that they just ignored them. And there's a danger in our life that we don't see the visible hand of God. And we don't recognize the fact that God is there in our everyday life, and we take for granted the beauty of God working with us. But there was magic going on in the tabernacle. There was things happening all the time that were incredible. And normally what you had is this whole procession of people bringing their animals and bringing their offerings, and everything had to go inside that courtyard for the priests to deal with it. Sometimes the people would go in as well, and they were a part of that sacrifice. They laid their hands on that sacrifice with the priest. Shared in it, intimately. And then they watched that animal, which represented their own life. Because God wasn't interested in the blood of animals. He was never interested in that. He was only interested in a person's life. And he was trying to teach them that these animals represented what he wanted from them. But then all of a sudden, you had this special one. Like, he was unique, he was beautiful. A beautiful red heifer. And all of a sudden, Eliezer came out of the temple. Tabernacle, and he's leading this red heifer, and like the child would go, where's he going, Dad? Where's he going with that cow? And he takes him outside the camp. And that animal was killed outside the camp. Totally different. Why is he doing that? Why is he not taking it inside? Why is it not done inside the temple, Dad? like all the other animals. Because in the story of the red heifer is the true story of God's intent. God's intent was always to try to purify the people and to reach outside the camp. It was about getting the people that were outside in, not keeping them out. And in the story of the red heifer is the story of God wanting to reconcile his people. And it's an incredible picture. And in the process of the red heifer, here's some of the things in Exodus, Numbers chapter 19. Eleazar was commissioned to officiate, which was unusual in itself, because normally Aaron was still alive at this stage, but specifically Eleazar was commanded to officiate in the offering of the red heifer. It was slain outside the camp before Eleazar's face. Its ashes were taken and they were laid up in a clean place outside the camp. The ashes were to purify from contamination of a dead body for the entire nation. So these ashes worked for the entire nation. So if you were walking along and you accidentally ran a touch a dead possum, because they were strewn all over the place, but if you touched something unclean accidentally, you were defiled, and you're like, oh, how do I ever get back into the temple? Well, you had this process where the ashes of this red heifer would purify you. And non-purification meant death and defilement of the entire sanctuary. So it begged the question, by the way, what happened if they couldn't find an unblemished red heifer? What happened to the nation? If you can't find an unblemished red heifer, what would ever happen to the nation? Because it was critical. The whole nation's purification existed in and around the ability to find a spotless red heifer. And today the Jews go in and, you know, that picture I had with the guy with the magnifying glass, I think you're allowed 7? Might be 5. 5 white hairs is qualified. So if you find 5 white hairs, it's okay, it qualifies as a pure red heifer. If there's 6, sorry, that one's disqualified. That's the process of trying to... That's what the Jews believe today, but maybe it was no white ears. It had to be pure, it just said. Now, interesting, John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus, it becomes a pivotal point in the ministry of Jesus, and it's very interesting that Lazarus and Eleazar are the very same name. There's no difference in these names. And the point is made and emphasized on 2 occasions that the red heifer was taken outside the camp and that these events with Lazarus happened outside the city. In fact, it emphasizes the fact that Mary went out of the city to meet with Jesus. The corruption of Lazarus, he'd been dead 4 days. And Martha said to Jesus that his body's probably now corrupted, it's probably smelly. You certainly wouldn't go anywhere near to touch it. It's a contaminated body. And then Jesus says, after the healing of Lazarus, he says, loose him. Go and touch him. And let him go. And you see this incredible principle where Jesus is acting or officiating over a dead body. Now here's the climax to show. It's interesting that Lazarus and Eleazar are the same. But you want the real evidence to show that this is what the story is leading back to? Or perhaps we should say the other way around. The story of the red heifer is the type of John chapter 11. Listen to the words at the end of the climax of the story of Lazarus. Caiaphas says what in verse 50? Caiaphas says it's expedient that one should die for the whole nation, that the whole nation perish not. That's the red heifer. It was the one animal which was given for the salvation of the entire nation, that the entire nation perish not. It was critical that this red heifer gave its life in order to purify the nation from the corruption of death. And no wonder it says in Hebrews, wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate. Here's the thing with John's gospel. And it's, to me, it's the most powerful thing as we come in to look at, we're going to look in the next few studies, we're going to look further and further inside the tabernacle. But in this first study, looking at that which is without, and I've just used Lazarus as the one example of that which is without, because I think that's representative of us all. But when you look at John's gospel, it's about Jesus going out of his way to reconcile those that are furthest outside the camp, those that are the most estranged, to bring them back. Because the lesson in John is about the Father's willingness to save. And it's about the Father's desire to reconcile. You see, Nicodemus missed the whole point, didn't he? He was of the belief that religion was about rules and regulations. It's about fences. It's about who's allowed in and who's not allowed in. And he was pure. That's what the Pharisees meant. They're separate ones. And by doing all of this and keeping yourself pure, you could be right with God. And John teaches, well, actually it's the Father that will provide the means to purify you. You cannot provide the means to purify yourself. And the Father is willing to provide the means to purify anybody who is willing to receive it. Anybody who is willing to receive it. And I like to think John is the gospel of empathy. You know, it says in Hebrews that we have not such a high priest who, you know, cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but Jesus was in all points tried as we are. He was touched with the feelings of our infirmities, and he reaches out to people. In John's gospel, think about the way in which you have so many character developments of people. John's the only one that kind of records that the influence that Jesus had on other people. Nicodemus, it took 3 years, but look what happened. You can follow the process with Nicodemus through chapter 3, chapter 7, and finally when he comes out of his shell in chapter 19. You can follow that development where Nicodemus is born again. You can follow it with the Apostle John himself. You can see John's change till he gets to John chapter 20 and says, and he saw these things and believed. You can see it with Peter, when thou art strengthened, converted, strengthen your brethren. You can see it with Thomas. You know, imagine John telling the story. Let me tell you the effect that Jesus had on Thomas. Thomas, mate, he was the pessimist. You should have met Thomas. Imagine John telling the story. You should meet Thomas. Talk about the glass half empty. He was always the one on the negative side. When Jesus said, let's go back to Judea again, Thomas says, yeah, let's all go back that we might die also. Yeah, great idea. And then after the death and resurrection of Jesus, Thomas went and hid in a shell. He was gone. Hid under a rock. Couldn't find him for a week. Because he was like, I told you so. I knew it was all going to happen. Warned you. Finally, after a week, he comes out of his shell. The man, you want to see Thomas now. Look at his statement at the end of John's Gospel. My Lord, my God. He understood the principle of God manifestation. And you see this change and development. And John is the one that deals with all of that. He does it with Philip. He does it with Andrew. You can follow the development of people. Mary Magdalene. He's intimate. Even his own mother. John chapter 2. Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. Then at the cross. Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother. John is dealing specifically with Jesus' influence on people. He's interested in the way Jesus changed because John says, as to many as received him, to them he gave power. He gave the power to become sons of God. Not I had the power to become a son of God. I had the ability to change myself. As to many as received him, to them he gave power to become the son of God. You know, with the woman of Samaria, she converted her whole country. By the time they went back in Acts chapter 8, that whole country of Samaria was ready to receive Jesus. And she was the one that started. Jesus didn't have to go and say to her, look, I think you need to change your life. It's a bit of a mess. You need to get it in order. He never said that. What he did was he turned her focus around to him. And when she grabbed a hold of that which is positive, God made the change. The Father made the change in her and she became a son of God with power. And John is that incredible gospel which is dealing with Jesus' special attention to us. He's touched with the feelings of our infirmities. It's the way he's reaching out to us. You know, I've kind of done this talk before, but it's a, for me it's probably the such a powerful lesson in John, and that is the way in which empathy trumps sympathy. You know, empathy is very, very different to sympathy, because empathy fuels connections. Sympathy drives disconnection. It pushes things away. Because empathy is truly feeling with somebody, somebody. And it's about sharing somebody's feelings. If I feel empathy with you, it means I have to connect. I have to connect with a feeling inside you that I can share. And that's a vulnerable process. It makes me vulnerable to that feeling. It's a painful process, and it's not a comfortable process. And men are completely useless at it. We are. You know why? Because men always want to fix something. You know, men are always like, if something's broken, we want to fix it. We always want to fix it. And so when somebody comes naturally to man and wants to express their feelings and wants to unload and say, you know, something tragic's happened, man doesn't know how to deal with it naturally in his own state. He wants to give some form of advice or some form of counsel, but sometimes people actually aren't looking for counsel. They're just looking for comfort. They're looking to share that emotion. And I think women are far better at it because God has made them that way. You know why? Because inside them, they've got this ability to carry a child. How strong a thing is that, that they can actually attach physically to another life being inside them? God has given this, and I think that's why God gave Adam Eve. Because Adam needed to learn this lesson of empathy. He needed to get in touch with his feelings for other people. You know, Peter was particularly useless at it. So was John. Do you remember Mary Magdalene at the tomb, John chapter 20? She was beside herself. Three times it says she wept, she cried, she was there. She ran off to get the disciples because she's lost the only person in her life that meant anything to her. She goes and gets the disciples and they came running to the tomb in John chapter 20 and they looked in and it says and they turned around and went to their own home and guess where they left Mary? And Mary stood without weeping, it says. Very next verse. They left her there. You know why? Because they didn't know how to deal with her. They didn't know how to deal with her emotion. They didn't know how to console her. It was too difficult. And no wonder Jesus would say to Peter, when you're converted, feed my lambs. When you're converted, feed my lambs, Peter. You need to learn this lesson of empathy. And John is full of this story about Jesus going outside the camp. Again, the difference between empathy and sympathy is, you know, you'll never hear the words at least from an empathetic spirit. But you'll hear the words at least from a sympathetic spirit. You know, something tragic happens in your life, something bad, something happens with your children, they drop out of school or do something bad, you know, Johnny's dropped out of school. Well, you know, at least Jane's an A grade student. It'll be all right. You know, I lost my job today. I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, at least you've got your health. You know, my back, I've got this disc. I don't know whether I'm ever going to be able to walk properly again. Well, at least you've got a good job and good income. And that word, at least, it doesn't fix anything. It doesn't fix anything at all. And the empathetic spirit is the spirit that says, well, I don't know what to say to that, but I'm glad you shared that with me. And if you ever want to talk to somebody, I'm there. And that's the thing that's difficult for us to do. And in John's Gospel, that's the beauty of the Lord who dwells amongst us, who goes outside the camp to find the people that were difficult to talk to, that had the most baggage, the biggest problems and the biggest issues, and he goes out of his way to find them, to bring them to his Father.